Welcome to the OnFit Podcast.
Thank you all for joining. I am Ellie Groves from OnFit, and I'm very pleased to be joined today by Francesco Papadia. He is a senior fellow at Bruegel, and he has spent many years in the central banking world. Between 1998 and 2012, he was Director General for Market Operations at the European Central Bank. He worked previously at Banca d'Italia. We also have Phil Papadakis, who is the macro strategist at Bank Lawbird Odier. And we also have John Nijay, who has an expansive career in the world of reserve management, including spells at the MAS and Bank of England. He will be joining us towards the end, and I'm pleased to invite him to ask a question of his own when we get to that point. But firstly, I want to turn to Francesco, who has recently published a book looking at construction of the ECB in the wider context of central banking in turbulent times. Please, could you, Francesco, outline the key themes of your book to kickstart this podcast?
Well, indeed, it's two books that you put together in a very nice way. The most recent one is a book that I've co-edited with three co-editors, which is a bit philosophical, but not deprived of market impact, because these talks about two different economic culture, the German culture and the Italian culture, especially when it comes to monetary policy and especially when it comes to central banking. And in this book, in which we have some 20 contributors, we try to assess not only the nature of these two different cultures, but how these different cultures have been bridged over in order to create a culture of the ECB. And at the end, our sense is that this matching has quite worked. I remember that Jean-Claude Trichet, the second president of the ECB, said that the ECB was very strong because it came from different lineages. So it's like a person who has different sources of DNA. And to some extent, this book proves this view of Jean-Claude Trichet. The other book is a book that I wrote with Tuomas Valimaki from the Finnish Central Bank, where we examine how the model of central banking that was prevailing before 2008 has changed to a very large extent because of the crisis, and how we can think of the future of central banking. Maybe this is an issue that we can further touch during our podcast.
Perfect. Thank you very much. That's a very clear, succinct summary of these two very interesting books that entwine, I feel, and definitely give a broad outline of perhaps, if I may, the central banking in turbulent times and also looking at the construction of the ECB as two separate things coming together. And obviously, as you mentioned, the ECB developed out of the creation of a monetary union. In 2003, it took a review on its strategy and aims. It's only now looking at this again. Much has happened since 2003, not only the COVID-19 crisis, which has slightly delayed this strategy review by six or so months. It was meant to be held last year and the outcome in November. This has obviously been put back a little to this autumn. So September, I believe they're thinking of releasing that strategy, but they're looking at that review currently. And kind of drawing from your books, both of them, but perhaps also the looking at the history of the ECB, do you think that this strategy review is overdue? Is it on time, or is it too soon to tell? Obviously, I think 2003 was the first time it relooked at its aims and strategy, and now we're onto it again. So first of all, let's start with both you, and then I'll bring Bill into this question as well about, do you think that this review is on time or overdue?
You are asking a question which is very simple and hard to answer. Very simple because, of course, as you said, I mean, it's 17 years since the last review. So you would say, well, 17 years, it's a long time. And which 70 years? With two crises, with very deep crises. Yes, so it's overdue. On the other hand, it's not clear what this review is trying to assess. We have some clarity about the fact that it will touch about green issues. But this, however important it is at global level, is not a central issue for central banking. It's an important issue, but not a central issue for central banking. We have heard that they want to revise, or it's likely that they want to revise their inflation objective. And I must say, I'm a bit skeptical that this is such an important issue as they make it. I made this conviction of mine more looking at the Fed than looking at because the Fed started with this question of inflation, and then they had their Fed listening exercises, and they found out to their surprise that people didn't care so much about inflation and whether inflation was at 2% or not. And so the main issue of the review, in a way, was put a bit aside, and the concentration was more about the real economy. And indeed, I mean, at the end, the review was more important for what it says about employment than what it says about inflation. And maybe the last comment I would like to make about the review, and you quote my book, Central Banking in Turbulent Times. There, the issues that are highlighted as being critical for the future are not issues that a central bank on its own can deal with. Say, the independence of the central bank is a constitutional issue. It's not an issue that a central bank can decide on its own. The overburdening of the central bank with many tasks is not something that a central bank can decide on its own. It's something that must come from a wider constituency. So maybe at the end, the strategy review can, by intrinsically, only address problems that are not the critical ones. The critical problems maybe fly at higher level than the monetary policy strategy review.
I want to come back to some of that later, but Phil, from the market's perspective, how are you feeling that the strategy review, the timing of it?
I certainly feel, to your original question, that it's fair to say that such a review is indeed overdue, because looking at the real economy as well as at financial markets, we can easily notice how many things have changed since the last time such an exercise was run in Europe, least of them being the level of interest rates today compared with the early 2000s, as well as the level of potential growth in which the economy operates, namely the factor that often constrains monetary policy, which is the zero low bar being hit way too often. We currently have a policy rate that's actually substantially below zero. And we know that as a result, the European Central Bank has had to change its operational framework to allow it to evolve and to use other instruments and not just the policy rate in order to hit its objective. And many of these decisions were taken either at the time of crisis or under pressure to achieve the objective. But of course, a review that puts the objective as well as the tools that are being used to accomplish that objective in the right context is definitely a useful and interesting evolution.
Mm. Thank you very much. I want to talk a little bit about the current ECB policy and the COVID-19 crisis, but I do want to get back to what the question of what functions will the ECB need to take to be most effective within the current economic climate we operate in, and some of those thinkings around, as Francesco mentioned, what are the things that the ECB should be focusing on that will really make that difference. So first of all, let's have a little bit of a discussion on, in light of the pandemic, how do you see the ECB's current monetary policy efforts, and have they gone far enough to offset the downturn effects? I want to get on to my second question within this, is the policy targets to achieve an inflation rate of close to but below 2%. How feasible is this target as well? So let's focus on have the monetary policy efforts gone far enough to reduce the pressure on the Eurozone we've seen from the COVID-19 crisis?
So what I would say is that the ECB response has come in really two phases. The original one, when it acted with urgency under the pressure of the onset of the pandemic in Europe, but also around the world. And it was in many ways very effective in alleviating the stress, in allowing financial markets to perform their functions, and also in creating fiscal space for member state governments that had to also perform very stimulative fiscal action. And that was a key element of the overall approach. Now, as the acute phase of the crisis is perhaps behind us and we'll go to a longer, perhaps somewhat more chronic phase of the crisis, then the ECB still has pressure to act in order to achieve its objectives. But so far, I would perhaps say that I see the approach that is taken as somewhat gradualist. So it has chosen to upsize the amount of asset purchases a couple of times so far. It has left open the possibility of doing it again if need be, but it has also occasionally stated that the whole envelope of asset purchases is not necessary that it will be used. And that has allowed for a certain amount of uncertainty in markets. So the most recent episode of rising real yields in the euro area, but as well as the rest of the global economy, has been an episode which puts the ECB in the spotlight, because to a large extent, that market move has come as a result of spillovers from the improving economic outlook in the US. And although in euro area, we haven't seen a similar improvement, we see to some extent a tightening of financial conditions. And that poses some question marks about the current action plan of the ECB. To your question more specifically as to whether the 2% inflation objective is feasible, I would say that it is for sure feasible if the right action plan is put into place. But it's undeniable that for many years now, in times of crisis, but also in calmer periods, the ECB has failed to deliver that exact objective. So perhaps a certain amount of rethinking of both the tools and the processes is quite appropriate in my view.
Francesco, do you have a perspective on that as well?
Yeah, I would just link to what Bill just said. There are two, there are more than two, but two issues that the strategy review could look at is one, the target, two, the tools to achieve the target. Now, again, I repeat what I said at the beginning, the concentration seems to be on redefining the target. But well, I would agree with Bill that maybe more important is why the ECB has not achieved the target now for 12 years. I don't know whether any one of you has seen the porcupine chart, the chart that gives the actual inflation in the euro area and the projections of the ECB. The projections of the ECB have a systematic tendency to go back towards 2%, and the actual rate of inflation has a systematic tendency of not going up to 2%. And I think that this should be the crux of the matter. This should be the issue on which the ECB concentrate. Why we have not been able to achieve our objective now for 12 years. And here I think that the discussion about the tools, about the plan, as Bill put it, is critical, because my sense is that even purchases, outright purchases, have lost much of their potency. So the interest rate, we know, is difficult to use because it's already negative. You don't know how far you can go into the negative domain. Large use of outright purchases, QE, call it PEP, call it as you wish. My sense is that this has entered the area of marginal decreasing effectiveness. Out of the issues that the ECB can look at, I said many issues that the ECB is not appropriate to look at because they fly higher at constitutional level. But among the issues that the ECB can look at, I would rather put the emphasis on the tool and the inability to achieve 2% more than on a revision of the 2%.
John, I'm at this point going to ask if you have any thoughts or questions around the current response for the pandemic from the ECB.
Well, thank you very much. Yes, actually, can I start by a very quick comment on the porcupine chart, which Francesco's just mentioned, which I think is at the heart of the challenge facing the ECB at the moment, because to not achieve its objective for so long suggests not that it's not doing the right thing, but that it doesn't fully understand the dynamics which are driving inflation. And this is a much more serious issue, because if a central bank doesn't understand the dynamics of inflation, it cannot possibly hope to successfully affect the outcome of inflation. I think it drives to the very heart of the inflation targeting central bank if you say that you have not fully understood the mechanics of what you are trying to control. And if after 12 years they haven't achieved what they set out to do, it's a legitimate question. And it leads to the question for me, had central banks had huge success in the 1990s and early 2000s in generating low and stable inflation? But the big question is whether they actually created it or whether they merely presided over it. And it was created from outside by the entry of China into world trade, by the suppression of the power of employees to raise wages, things like that. That, I think, is the heart of the question. And I'm sure Francesco addresses it, because unless you understand how inflation works, you cannot possibly hope to be successful in controlling it. It will be luck if you control it rather than skill. Now, as for what the ECB is doing now, if I can just speak very briefly on that, and as for its expectations, the challenge is that central banks have become far more important in the public eye, and far more is expected of them. In the past, if we go back 15 to 20 years, they were one instrument, one target, institutions. They had the instrument of monetary policy and the target of monetary stability. But they now appear to me to be three instrument, three target institutions. Their three instruments are interest rates, monetary policy, their balance sheet, quantitative easing, and macroprudential controls. But they are no better off, because as well as moving from one instrument to three instruments, they move from one target to three targets. They're still, of course, charged with controlling inflation. They have the new charge of ensuring financial stability, particularly important after the global financial crisis 12 years ago. And they seem to have been given responsibility for economic performance, economic growth, which I always used to think was more of the Treasury Finance Ministry's responsibility, and where fiscal policy had a bigger role to play. So our central banks have three targets and three instruments. They are back in this challenge of having just about enough if everything goes well. They don't have any leeway. But as well as being back in the position of not having any leeway, they are in the unfortunate position of being far bigger in the public eye, far more is expected of them, far higher profile. And of course, from that position, it is far easier to fail.
Thank you. I want to come back to that. Francesco and Bill have some thoughts around this. So I definitely want to circle back to the macroprudential question and responsibility of a central bank. But I also just want to pick apart a little bit. I have one further question on the monetary policy immediacy respect to the ECB's thinking behind here potentially. And the ECB's monetary policy have remained to the greatest extent unchanged since the end of last year. We're obviously getting into a recovery phase in Europe, hopefully, if the vaccine program continues. We also have the Next Generation EU Fund, which is on a longer term trajectory. Has this kind of reduced the pressure for the ECB to have to respond? Do you think there might be a monetary policy shift within the ECB this year, or will we see a pretty stable, much of the same within the short term? And then I guess in the longer term, what is the pathway back to normalization? Do we feel that the Next Generation EU Fund and the national spending commitments from the fiscal side have given the ECB a sight towards tightening their monetary policy again? Or do we feel that the ECB loosened monetary policy is here to stay?
I think that we can exaggerate the importance of the EU Resilience and Recovery Fund in conjunctural terms. It's very important. That program is very important in institutional terms. It's very important over the medium run. I don't think it has a lot of importance over the conjunctural situation. Most of the funds will not be spent before 22-23. Of course, there can be an anticipation effect, both in the market and in the behavior of national authorities. The market could see this coming and they could anticipate that. National authorities could see this coming and feel free to spend more. But the conjunctural action, to me, doesn't have much to do with the EU facility. What is most important, in my view, is the situation in the euro area about infection and vaccines. Because this is, we know that this is keeping a strong lid on activity. And as soon as you take away the lid, activity will go up. The problem is we are not sure when this lid will be taken away because Europe or the euro area is late on vaccination. There are the mutations that are coming. I've seen some estimate maybe Europe, continental Europe, behind the United States and the United Kingdom because it should accelerate us from April, but we are not sure about that. So I think that from a conjunctural point of view, COVID and vaccination are the critical issues. I tend to have a fairly optimistic view here. I think that by the summer, enough people would be vaccinated. Enough people would have had COVID to add immunity to the vaccinated people for economic activity to return towards a normality. But that is a guess. There is no real evidence about that because that very much depends on how the infections and how vaccination goes. But I wanted to add a little more pessimistic note to what John said about the three objectives and three instruments. Because I'm afraid that I've seen at least another two objectives coming on the shoulders of central banking. Income distribution and resource allocation. So traditionally, central bank said, oh, income distribution, resource allocation is not our business. But now, if you listen to the Fed, they do care about income distribution. If you listen to the ECB in different ways, they do care about income distribution. And they do resource allocation. They favor this or that other sector, this or this other borrowers. So I'm afraid that the consoling equality of targets and objectives is maybe not so solid as John put it.
Thank you. I think that that's a very interesting point around the expectations of a central bank as they have become more into the public eye, and also that their response in the 2008 global financial crash has definitely put them more into the public eye. So I think that that is one to watch, definitely, and something I do want to go back to. But firstly, Bill, I'd like to pick up on this question about the Next Generation EU Fund and the potential pathway back to normalization that the ECB can see. I think from summarizing from Francesco's point and from John's, this is going to be a huge challenge for the ECB, and one that is not going to be in the short term. I feel that the PEP program, at least in some form, might be here to stay.
Sure. So to begin with, I would say that I strongly agree with the point that Francesco already made about the Next Gen EU Fund. I think it's important to be clear about what the facility is and what it is not, because if we'd like to put a positive spin on it, of course it is a historic breakthrough in creating some central fiscal capacity in Europe, something that was missing. And if this in an effective manner, maybe that can be used to shift the current mindset about fiscal matters in Europe further, and we can have a positive evolution to the future. But this is more of a medium to long-term sort of question. And the immediate question for the current economic conjuncture is much more about the counter-cyclical fiscal response that is needed to diminish the impact of the COVID crisis, as well as helping a sharper recovery. So using this to the question whether the ECB will see a path to normalization in the near future, I think there are two key elements to look at here. One would be whether we get a more aggressive, more expansionary fiscal response that helps this recovery along. I'm somewhat pessimistic on that front from the member state responses that we've seen so far. We're not seeing anything similar to, say, the US approach on this issue. And as said previously, the recovery fund inflows will only start late this year and really accelerate from next year onwards. The second factor, where perhaps I'm a little bit more optimistic about, is whether a sharp recovery will naturally follow the moment of reopening once the vaccination campaign has picked up pace and the number of cases across the continent has really decreased substantially. I think on that front, the lesson from last year was really that the moment the restrictions are lifted and stringency is really loosened on economic activity, then the pace of that economic activity can really pick up quite sharply in the near term. And perhaps that would be not necessarily an achievement of the ECB itself, but it would be an overall backdrop that is positive enough to allow it to start thinking about normalization. But frankly, we're still a long way from there. It won't be probably before 2022 that Europe has reached this pre-COVID level of output, and it will take some time more to catch up to the pre-crisis trend, right? So only then will thinking about normalization become appropriate. So we're several quarters away from that, in my view.
Thank you very much. And we will obviously have had the outcome of the ECB strategy review by then as well, which will be an interesting point for the ECB to reflect and focus on as well. I think there are a couple of questions that UMFIF have been grappling with actually, what does it look like? What does normal look like? And coming out of this crisis, especially when we're looking at the next crisis being a climate crisis and having had years of low for long, it would be interesting to you actually see the fiscal and monetary policy normal in quote marks, as it were. And to go to that point, Francesco, in a blog post you've written recently, you mentioned that Andrea and Rhea, the head of the supervisory wing of the ECB, should definitely be added to the group of people one should look at to assess ECB policy, since his part of the ECB is clearly and rightly going beyond its macro supervisory role and taking on a macro prudential one. Do you see the scope of central banking becoming wider? I want to kind of circle into this also the climate crisis and the central banks looking at the greening the financial system. What are the positives, but also what are the risks to this?
Well, I think that I have had for a very long period of time a skeptical view about the macroprudential policies. And one, or maybe the strongest reason for this skepticism was that I see the institutional setup for conducting macroprudential policies in Europe, but also in the United States, I must say, as not appropriate. There is no clear view of who is responsible with which tools for macroprudential policies. So I have expressed a view that the central bank may be in an acute dilemma between financial stability and price stability. Say it has to keep interest rates very low because of price stability, but then incurring into financial stability risk because too low rates of interest tend to push people toward more risky behavior and riskier choices. So that was my point of departure, skepticism about the macroprudential policies. I think that what the supervisory wing of the ECB under Andrea and Rhea is doing goes some way into limited this worry of mine, because I think that the ECB has shown that it takes macroprudential considerations into account in carrying out its function. It's a supervisor. So in principle, a supervisor should limit itself to micro issues. But it's very good that the ECB is taking instead a macro approach. And the evidence of this is what the ECB did in lessening capital charges for banks at the beginning of the COVID crisis. I said this goes some way into attenuating my fears. Why don't I take a more buoyant interpretation? Because, of course, there is another part of the financial system, which is the non-bank part, which is not under the supervision of the ECB. So what the ECB is doing is very important for banks, but there remains another part, which is totally not under the control of the ECB. So the macroprudential policies applies to an important part of the financial system, but does not apply to another important part of the financial system. So I think that the ability to sum up, the ability of a macroprudential policy to really deal with the financial stability risk is a bit better than I feared, but still not complete and not to the point of relieving the ECB from the dilemma situation in the use of its interest rate.
Thank you very much. And Bill, I'd want to come to you for those questions around the scope of the central bank widening. Perhaps if you could come in on some of the climate questions as well and the role of the central bank there.
So I certainly think Francesco makes a very strong point on this question. From my side, although being no specialist by any means on macroprudential policies, what I would highlight is that the current crisis as well as the previous crisis have perhaps taught us that we no longer live in the simple world where each institution could only be responsible for a very narrow mandate and we could ignore the interplay between fiscal actors, monetary actors, macroprudential regulators, etc. For good or bad, many of these elements are interconnected, and something going wrong in one part of the system can have severe repercussions on the other. So the need for coordination is certainly there. And I guess from today's standpoint, looking at Mario Draghi being head of government in Italy, looking at where Janet Yellen is or where Christine Lagarde is as head of the ECB, it certainly brings the point home that there are important skill sets in being able to coordinate policies across these different areas. How to design these processes and how to implement them, especially in a time of crisis, I think will be a particularly big challenge, especially as, coming back to the previous point made here, many of these mandates are broadened. And the question on climate change is of course an important one, because as we've said previously, with central banks not having been able to really deliver on their more narrow mandate in the past, once this mandate is even broadened by adding questions on things like climate change, I think the questions become even bigger and harder to respond. So for me, that will be a critical element, both at the present time, but also in the future.
Thank you so much. We're coming to the end of our half an hour discussion. So I just want to swiftly sum up kind of the key points that I think we've really addressed, which is that central banks, especially the ECB and others, have huge challenges on their hands, especially as they move more into the public eye and are seen to expand their mandates or hold responsibility for more things. And we see that definitely coming to the key discussions on the strategy review, which is, I think, 17 years after the other one, probably in good time, if not very much needed. But before we close, I do want to go to Francesco and Bill, you again, just to say any closing remarks or any things that we perhaps haven't addressed in detail in this discussion, or if you want to circle back to make a key point.
Well, rather than my closing thoughts, you will have my closing advertisement, because you were kind enough to mention my two books, and let me give a little more detail about them. So the latest one is called The Value of Money, Controversial Economic Cultures in Europe, Germany versus Italy, and this has just been published by Villa Vigoni, a publisher. The other book is about 2 years old, and this is Central Banking in Turbulent Times, published by Oxford University Press, and that is a book that I wrote with Thomas Valimaki, as I said, while the other one I've edited with three co-editors. So this is my last thought, and I hope it remains impressed in the mind of the listeners, and they run to buy the books.
Thank you so much. I would strongly recommend that these books are incredibly interesting and engaging. So Bill, I just want to say thank you very much for joining us as well. It's been very interesting to hear your perspective, and we're very pleased to be joined by you. So thank you very much. Do you have any closing thoughts as well?
For me, the only thing I would add was perhaps to go towards your direction and say that strategy review done by the ECB is a hugely important matter for sure, but also for Europe in the future, a review of the fiscal framework and the existing fiscal rules that have been in place for a while now, and the world has changed since, I think will be a very important question to monitor and potentially interesting material for a future podcast. So looking forward to that.
I want to say thank you to John Nuzzi as well for joining us and having his very intelligent remarks brought in halfway through this as well. So thank you all.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the OnFIF podcast.